This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Ask any baby boomer about some of their best memories growing up, and chances are mighty good a drive-in theater figures in there somewhere.
As you leave the theater, folks, be sure to remove the speaker before you leave. If you should accidentally pull a speaker loose, please turn it in at our snack bar or box office. Thank you.
It was a wonderful, uniquely American thing. You roll up to the parking spot, perch the little speaker on your window, order lots of food, and then watch movies from your car. Kids would go in their PJs and watch movies while lying on the roof of the station wagon. Now, for teenagers in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, well, perhaps the movie was a secondary attraction, if you catch my drift. This summer marks the 80-year anniversary of the invention of the drive-in movie theater. After a slow start, the trend really took off. Detroit got its first drive-in theater in 1938. So we wanted to take a trip back in time to the glory days of the drive-in. Joining us is Philip Hallman, who's with the University of Michigan's Department of Screen Arts and Culture. Welcome to Stateside. Thanks for coming into the studio, Philip.
Thank you very much.
So who first came up with the idea of the drive-in?
Well, actually, it's credited to a man named Richard Hollingshead. He was in Camden, New Jersey, and he was the son of an auto parts dealer.
Yeah.
And he tried to use it as a way to boost his auto sales business. But, you know, being the 30s, the Depression,
sure.
Trying to kind of create an entrepreneurial type venture, he used this as a launching pad. It took a while, though, to get off the ground. There really weren't a lot in the first, say, decade. But was it
because the business climate wasn't good, or was
it
because
I think it was a combination of a number of things. He had a patent on it.
Mm-hmm.
The patent was actually had to do with his design of the theater, which in order to see over another car, you had to have some kind of hill or ramp. And so his patent was for the ramp that he created.
Okay.
But he had a lot of trouble kind of upholding the patent, and a lot of people ignored it. And so he never really got the benefits of the patent. And it was slow to take off. I think, you know, it is the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
There aren't a lot of automobiles in the country to begin with during this period. If you look at statistics, in 1945, right after the war, there are something like 25 million cars registered in the United States.
Okay.
A decade after that, it more than doubles, and you get almost 60 million cars registered in within a 10-year period. So you didn't have a lot of potential filmgoers in the 30s. But as the decades move on, you certainly do, and that picks up.
So you had folks with cars by the time we were in the post-World War II era.
Exactly.
In the Cold War era, if you will.
Right.
Yes. But the going to the movies was an essential part of the American experience in the 30s,
wasn't
absolutely.
It? I mean, we're talking in the neighborhood. I think it's a little bit mind-boggling for us nowadays to think about, but something like 80 million people a week went to the movies. You're talking nearly 70% of the population attending a movie at least once a week.
If not more, right?
Right. And I think it's typical that people would go more than once a week. In fact, the neighborhood theaters, you have to keep in mind there's a structure of how film theaters are organized in this period. You've got the downtown movie theater. So if we take Detroit as an example, which I think a lot of your listeners would be familiar
sure.
with. In the Grand Circus Park area, for example,
there Madison.
Absolutely, yeah. The
I remember that, yeah.
The Fox,
Adams.
The Michigan Theater, all
yep.
the grand theaters. Now, these are theaters that held upwards of 5,000 people.
Serious theaters.
Right, and yeah. they were full, right? And so that was the main theater, and they played the newest films, the best films coming out of the studios. And then, you know, Detroit is kind of fan-shaped. So as you move away from Grand Circus into the neighborhoods, you get two different types of theaters that are neighborhood-oriented. One is similar to the downtown theater, but smaller.
Mm-hmm.
And they would play this similar type of film. After it left the downtown, it would move more to the neighborhood.
I grew up in Ferndale, and it was the Radio City,
right at
9 and Woodward, or just north of 9 and Woodward.
Exactly.
Yes.
And then in addition to that, most big neighborhoods would have a second neighborhood theater, and that would play the kind of B pictures, the cowboy westerns,
okay.
the gangster-type films, and those would change three times a week. So this is the scenario that the drive-in faces and immediately comes in competition with that second type of theater that I talked about.
The B.
Yeah. And there was a lot of hostility and animosity between the drive-in owners and the established theater, indoor theater owners, right from the start. And so that helped create or stall the advancement of it around right at the beginning as well.
But as the American public got more cars and got past World War II and you had the booming families, it was a great way to get out with the kids, wasn't it?
Yeah, and then we move away from a downtown culture to a suburban culture. And that really plays into the drive-in experience as well. Drive-ins really are geared for two types of audience, the suburban audience as well as the rural audience. And if you look at the state of Michigan, a map of the state of Michigan, for example, you'll see this played out. So there's a heavy concentration in some of the bigger cities like Detroit, Grand Rapids, Flint, but an equal amount in the smaller communities as well, throughout the Thumb, the center, the northern part, and even, believe it or not, into the Upper Peninsula. I believe they had about five or six. In spite of the bad weather up there, they still had drive-ins.
They still had summertime.
Right.
But I can remember going to the drive-in at Square Lake Road and Telegraph on New Year's Eve with my mom and dad when I was in high school. I'm such a nerd. Catch 22 was playing, and I wanted to record it on my little reel-to-reel recorder. And they, my folks, sat there with me on, with the heater.
Yes, exactly.
Watching that movie.
Well, believe it or not, I spent a New Year's Eve at the drive-in as well. A few years later than that, but my father, managed this drive-in theater, so it was part of my family growing up. And all of my brothers worked in the drive-in. I eventually worked in a different drive-in, but it was part of our family experience.
It's in the blood. I'm speaking with Philip Hallman, who's with the University of Michigan's Department of Screen Arts and Culture, and we're celebrating the 80-year anniversary of the invention of the drive-in movie theater. So for those who may not have experienced drive-ins in their heydays, in their glory days, in the 50s and the 60s and the early 70s, take us to the experience, Philip.
Well, for me, it was a grand experience because I went with my father, and so we had to get there when the gates opened and stay until they closed. So for me, one of my fondest memories was going in the summer, at the height of summer, and staying until literally 6 in the morning when the sun came up, and we, they couldn't show the movie any longer because the sun was up. But that wasn't a typical experience for most. I mean, most people would go with their family, and they, as you said in the introduction, they'd bundle the kids up, usually put them in their pajamas. Mm-hmm. The kids would play in
the little playground.
Yeah. And I think, you have to keep in mind that, it doesn't get dark until
9 or 10.
So, the opportunity to show films is limited for outdoor people compared to the amount of shows that an indoor theater can get. So one way that they compensated was to have entertainment and things to do prior to the start of the movie.
Okay.
So one of these opportunities was the playground. But in addition to that, there were lots of other things too. Not so much in this area, but across the country, they'd have things like swimming pools and miniature golf courses, pony rides, all kinds of contests. I've read about, the typical pie-eating contests, beauty contests, all that sort of thing. But then the community would get involved, too, by having dances and, all kinds of public displays of community-oriented activity as well. So all of this was a way to bring people to the drive-in, to give it a sense of experience that you didn't get in the indoor theater.
And I would also suspect that a real big part of bringing money in had to have been the snack bar.
Oh, absolutely. And in my mind, the snack bar and the relationship between the drive-in and the snack bar really is what makes the drive-in experience quite unique. I feel that the drive-in set the precedent for the fast food industry. If you think about now, it's very common for people to go through a drive-through to eat in the car. But in the 30s and 40s, this didn't happen. You know, well, people.
For us growing up in the 60s, you would, you know, get the little box from the snack thing and go right. back and eat in your car was very different.
Exactly. And so my sense is that the drive-in didn't create the fast food industry, but it helped to propel the notion of us eating outside of the home. And this is really a big change in American culture at this time. You know, it really enforces the sense that the drive-in is a unique experience.
Hey, Mom. Yes, you. Why fuss and fret about dinner? Why not have it right here? Yes, this drive-in offers everyone in the family a real picnic treat for dinner. We've got delicious sandwiches with all the trimmings and your other dinner favorites, plus whatever you want to drink, hot or cold. Come early before the show starts, or eat while you're being entertained, or at intermission time. So why fuss? Give your family a tasty dinner at this drive-in.
So you have both, you know, you're in your car, which is sort of odd to be doing anything other than driving. But here you're in your car with your family. So you're creating, in a sense, a kind of ersatz home outside of the home.
And right? Now we all say the car that we commute in, it's our rolling home on, you know, portable home.
Exactly. And so here you combine two things that America loves, the automobile and the movies. And it seemed like it seemed odd at the time, but now it seems extremely normal.
Now, the waning of the American drive-in, it wasn't just a matter of the fact we can have giant flat screens and surround sound in our homes, because they began to wane before that technology, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the drive-in is never known for being a high-tech experience. Mm-hmm. You didn't go because you had the best picture or the best sound or the best, you know, viewing experience. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you wanted that, you went to the large movie palaces in the downtowns. Okay. But this was different. This was an opportunity, as I said, to be a home away from home, to have an experience of being part of a community, but at the same time having an individual experience. And so the drive-ins always had problems technologically right from the start. I mean, you know, you're dealing with the weather, which is very changeable. So, you know, if it rains, how do you deal with that? So, of course, they came up with all kinds of solutions to come up with these various shields, lots of bugs. They came up with ways to deal with that. The sound was never very good. In the early days, they would just use one gigantic speaker and blast the sound out.
Okay.
And, of course, that created problems. Especially if anyone lived in the area nearby.
Neighbors wouldn't. One thing if you're in the country and it's in somebody's field, but another
right.
thing if there's a neighborhood.
Exactly. And I think drive-ins did try to build outside of the cities, but certainly growth happened mm-hmm. and the various neighborhoods would encroach on the space, and so you'd have problems with neighbors.
Yes. But as the suburbs changed, I believe the one that we used to go to at Square Lake and Telegraph is now where the Costco is. So there became a whole different demand
well,
for that
exactly.
property.
Exactly. And that's part of the problem that happens for the drive-in owners. There's a sense, I think what's happened with drive-ins and the ones that keep going, there's a real sense of loyalty. They're in families. These have long been part of the family. It's a family-owned business. But the lure of someone paying a lot of money for you to sell the property was too good and, mm-hmm. you know, too tempting for a lot of people. And so what happened, if you look at where most of the drive-ins were located mm-hmm. now, as you say, there are Targets or other, mm-hmm. you know, box store type things there, strip malls.
And I can't let you go without at least acknowledging, we've talked about the importance for the moms and dads and the kids, but for the teenagers of America, where else could you go to get away from mom and dad
well,
and get a little privacy?
Exactly. I mean, they definitely are known for being kind of motels on wheels.
The
so
necking
speak.
Capital
yeah.
of America.
Right. But also, you know, what happens is that an entire kind of new way of filmmaking gets generated by that audience. So the drive-ins had trouble getting first-run films from the major studios. So a whole new industry of filmmaking crops up that's geared for that particular audience. And these are low-budget films that okay. are meant entirely for this young teenage audience.
So those horror movies and those sci-fi movies from the 50s that were kind of cheesy
right.
were made for that.
Perfect for a young audience. Perfect for, you know, a low-budget crowd who doesn't have high expectations of what they're going to see.
And how many drive-ins can be found in America? From a peak of what to what's the head count?
Well,
today?
I think at its highest point in the late 50s, early 60s, there were just shy of 5,000. Right now, we're talking about around 300. For a while, it was stabilized at 500. But as you know, the last year has been difficult for theater owners in general who've been forced to switch over to the digital projection. And this has affected drive-ins most, because do they want to spend the $100,000 or whatever to invest in the new system if they don't really know if they're going to be around for that much longer? But I think there'll always be drive-ins for as long as people like watching movies outside. In fact, what's funny is that I think people go to the drive-ins and actually don't even sit in the car anymore. They take chairs and sit outside of the car, but they just want to be outside, and have that experience of being under the sky at night. It's wonderful.
Well, happy 80th birthday to the drive-in movie theater. I've been speaking with Philip Hallman with the University of Michigan's Department of Screen Arts and Culture. Thanks for the walk back to some great memories, Phil.
Well, thank you very much.
Hurry, hurry, step right this way, folks, for the most extravagant array of refreshment goodies ever assembled under one roof. Enjoy breathtaking, taste-tempting candies of finest quality. Enjoy popcorn exploded into tender, delicious, crispy bites of crunchy goodness. Enjoy the Tops in cool, refreshing soft drinks. If you want to enjoy some refreshments, this is your opportunity. There will now be a short intermission.